We are starting off a new series, a series about 4 weeks, 5 weeks long. We're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians, and we're going to be looking at it using a book that we've used before. John Shepherd is the one to blame, really, for this series, because he's a great fan of a chap called Ken Bailey, whom I think you must have met or known from your childhood. Your parents knew him. Okay, he obviously made a big impression. Lucky you weren't called Ken, aren't you? Anyway, he's somebody who was very, very sort of influential, clearly, in John's life. And John has kept sort of pushing bits and pieces of Ken's thinking into the study that we do. And Ken died last year. Ken died on, I think it was a Tuesday, and on the Sunday before that, we'd actually been using some of his material to study 1 Corinthians. We'll come back to that in a minute. And he's written several books that really look at the sort of the Arab culture and the cultures around the Mediterranean that spawned the gospel in the first place. And he spends time reading old versions of the New Testament, and he brings the whole thing together. And the book is called Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes. There's another book that he's written that we've also used from time to time, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. That's right, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. And there's a lot of really deep cultural stuff in there, and it's not that expensive a book. I would encourage you to get your hands on a copy, buy a copy. You can borrow a copy from me. What is it they say? It's better to give than to lend, and it costs about the same. So, you know, you can get your hands on my copy if you want, or borrow perhaps one of John's copies as well. We're going to be spending some time thinking about how Ken Bailey has looked at the structure of 1 Corinthians. So let's try and get to grips with this letter, the letter that Vicky started to read out to us. So, first question is, who's it from? Well, it's from Paul. We put our name at the bottom of a letter. They would put their names at the start of the letter. Paul, called to be an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God. And then there's this other chap, Sosthenes, and we don't know who he is, but there is a Sosthenes that occurs early on in the story of the church at Corinth, and it's probable that it's the same chap. In the chapter that Luke describes the church being founded in Corinth, he says this: when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews of Corinth made a united attack on Paul and brought him to the place of judgment. And they complain to the person in charge. And just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to them, "If you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you. But since it involves questions about words and names and your own law, settle the matter among yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things." So he drove them off. Then the crowd there turned on Sosthenes, the synagogue leader, and beat him in front of Gallio, the proconsul, and Gallio showed no concern whatsoever. So it's an angry crowd has come together. They want to they want the proconsul, the Roman chap in charge of the area, they want him to take action against Paul. And he says, look, this is a religious matter. I'm not going to judge between two religious groups. You deal with it. And Paul isn't around, or they don't dare not touch Paul, I don't know. So they grab the synagogue leader. Now, if you read earlier on, the previous synagogue leader, Crispus, had just been converted, so he wasn't running the synagogue anymore. He was part of the church. And this chap, Sosthenes, takes their ire, and they beat him up in front of the Roman governor, and the Roman governor doesn't care at all. And I don't know what the backstory is, but somehow this chap ends up traveling with Paul on his mission. How would you like that? I'm the chap that got you into trouble, and let's be friends. You know, I don't know how that relationship kicked off, really, between Sosthenes and Paul.
but he's now writing the letter with Paul. So the story there is in Acts chapter 18. You can see how Paul started in the synagogue, moves out of the synagogue, and the riot that ensues. And a similar pattern happens in the next chapter when he moves on to Ephesus. So, who's it to? So that's the next question. Well, it's to them, to the church of God in Corinth. And then one of the things that's surprising that sets this letter apart from almost every other letter, maybe every other letter in the New Testament, is that it's also to everybody, everywhere, who calls on the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's to a group of people in a particular place, at a particular time, long ago, far away, and it's to everybody, everywhere, who believes. That's to us. It's one of the few letters that you can actually say, not just that God in a general way expects us to take something from it, but in a very particular way, it's got our name on it too. I just think that's lovely, and that's one of the few letters in the New Testament that is as specific as that in addressing itself to every single person who puts their faith in Jesus Christ. Now, where is it? The map, the sort of the curly bit on the left-hand side, the southernmost part of the red journey, the journey there is Paul's second missionary journey. That's Corinth. The bit Achaia is the sort of the bit that comes down on the left-hand side there. You can see that Paul spent some time there. That's Corinth. And then he moves on from Corinth. He sails across the sea to the east, and he arrives in Ephesus. And it sounds like, and we'll start to get into this next week, it sounds like he starts to hear things about the church that he's founded in Corinth. The church that's come together in Corinth is facing all kinds of challenges and difficulties. And so Paul writes a letter. Maybe Sosthenes takes it back with him, I don't know. But Paul writes a letter to the church in Corinth. And he writes it. The question is, does he write it quickly? Is he dashing it off? What sort of a letter has he written? I just want to pause a little bit here and say something that I hadn't intended to say, because we've got a map in front of us, and we've got a very quick picture there of the whole world at that time. The world around the Mediterranean was the known world, and the way in which the gospel was spreading out, and the way in which churches sent people from one place to another. And we've heard a couple of stories this morning about places that our church has had an impact in. Our young people have been in Uganda. We're going to hear more about what they've done. We've had a very emotional appeal, really, to do something about a Christian group that are seeking to work with young people who have disabilities in Varna. What are we supposed to make of these things that happen? I think it's important that we, when we get these opportunities, that we just stop a little bit and think, what is God saying to us as a church when people come back and they tell us about what's happened in another part of the world? Is it something that we can get involved in? In a church I was at in Chelmsford, some people saw an orphanage in Romania and got very burdened by that. And in the end, and they did something that we could do if we wanted to in this church. They set up a charity, they built a church building, they built a bakery so that people could feed themselves, the Christians there. And then one of the people from that group moved out, and he lives there with his wife in that part of Romania. I don't know what this is the first step towards, but I don't think that we should just say, we'll think about it next summer. I think it's worth thinking about now. What is it that God might have as a connection between this church and the Christians in Varna? We're already supporting that work partly. Part of the regular giving from this church goes to Agnieszka? Is that, have I got
George.
George and Anna, sorry. And that goes out every month from this church. Is it something we can build on? Is it something we could do? And in many ways, I think as a church, we would really benefit from having a very expensive and big project that we got on with in another part of the world. I think it would be a phenomenal blessing to us. We've seen the way that the guides led us into Nepal by supporting some school children there, paying their education, getting them through school, And then that's turned into something where somebody from this fellowship has gone out to Nepal, and Annie lives there. And just this week, I discovered that the pastor that Annie has is a friend of another friend of mine's, and they're doing Bible development work. And I wrote to him, and I copied Annie in. And it's amazing the way these networks grow and grow and grow. And what we've heard this morning about connections that we have around the world, we need to go away and just pray about it and think, what is it that as a church we could be doing in those parts of the world? Paul was burdened not just to take the gospel. He did take the gospel, but actually a lot of what he ends up doing is ferrying gifts around from richer churches to poorer churches as well. So why did he write the letter? Well, the traditional view of 1 Corinthians is that it is an answer to a set of questions. He tells us in next week's talk, he tells us that he's heard, and it's clear that there's some written questions, things that are going wrong, and that 1 Corinthians is just a set of answers to those questions. Fragmented messages. And perhaps it's written in haste. If you ask most people, what's the most structured letter that Paul writes? What's the place where he gets the gospel together? Most people would say, that's the book of Romans. That's not the way that Ken Bailey sees it, okay? So whatever you believe, for a little while, you've just got to think, I'm going to try and see not this book through Mediterranean eyes, but through Ken Bailey's eyes. And Ken says, actually, we know that when Paul wrote this book, he was already in Ephesus. And one of the things that he did in Ephesus was he rented a lecture hall and he lectured about Christianity. Every day during siesta time from 11 till about 2 in the afternoon, when people would take their break, Paul was there and they would filter in and he would preach the gospel. And as a rabbi, as somebody who'd learned to preach, we can guess that he'd sort of structured his thinking, and that over that 18 months, when he was preaching over and over again, that he starts to structure his thinking. And we'll think a little bit about the structure of the book of Corinthians next week. But Ken Bailey is convinced that 1 Corinthians is a very, very, very well-structured piece of work. It's a very clever piece of work. And he said this isn't an absent-minded or a scatterbrained approach to answering a few questions. He said Paul has actually thought about the questions and he sort of integrated them into a very, very structured piece of thinking. And he says, Ken says, actually 1 Corinthians is basically 5 essays about how to live as a Christian. We've actually, in the past, we've studied 2 of them. We did Food Offered to Idols, if you remember that, last year, and we did Men and Women in Worship. We've already done 2 of the 5 essays using Ken Bailey's book as a basis. And what we're going to look at now is The Cross and Christian Unity. We're going to look at the first of the essays that make up this book of 1 Corinthians. And we'll kick that off, God willing, next week when we look from verse 10 in chapter 1 to the end of chapter 4. So, he's going to kick off his letter. How does he start the letter? Well, we've noticed that we've worked out who wrote it. We've worked out who it's to. We've seen that we're included in that. We've looked at where it was written to and where it was written from. We've taken a look at that. It was written to Corinth, to people in Corinth. It was written from Ephesus. Now, if you study Ken Bailey, he will tell you that there are 9 points in this opening. And I can never remember more than 3 points. So I thought, I cannot possibly. And if I can't remember, I've got quite a good memory. I didn't think you would manage with 9 points either. You have these people. We had a vice chancellor once who had a 21-point improvement plan. And, improvement plans, you can get by with 3 points, 5 points, no more than that, if you're going to have people remember what you're doing. And so I didn't think that we could really do that. I would suggest you take the book away, look at 1 Corinthians. I just wanted to pick out 2 pieces that sort of come together that should be an encouragement for us. First of all, there's a word that appears twice, and it's not translated the same way in our Bible. In one place, it says, God is confirming our testimony about God among you. And in another place, It's saying God will keep you firm to the end. This idea of being firm, being established, being in good shape. And then the second word that he uses, he reminds his people that God is faithful. So we've got the word being made firm, which is repeated, and there is the fact that God is faithful. Now, why does Paul want to impress this upon the people that he's writing to, upon their minds? And we can only guess, really, from the letter. And in fact, the two letters of Corinthians are really quite difficult to deal with, because it looks like there may have been some other letters written that we don't have. So we don't have the letters that are written from the church, or the people that reported from the church to Paul. We don't have that bit of the conversation. And it looks like there might be some letters that Paul wrote back to Corinth that we haven't got. It may not be. We don't know. It's a little bit ambiguous the way that Paul writes. So why is it that he stresses God's faithfulness? If you know anything about the book of 1 Corinthians, you know that it was a church that had tremendous gifts, phenomenally gifted people, talented people, spiritual gifts, all kinds of things that this church enjoyed. But it was also a church with really, really deep-seated problems. They were suing one another and taking one another to court just like that. There was a chap who was sleeping with his father's wife. There were all kinds of rabble-rousing during their services, and their communion service was such that some people managed to get enough wine to get drunk, and other people were starving. Really sort of anarchic behavior. And this is a church that Paul is writing to. Has it all gone wrong? Is this church going to be a wreck in the end? After the months that he's put in training them, working with them, appointing leadership, and now is it all going to fall apart? And actually, if you look at it, the things that he thanks God for are the fact that they don't lack any spiritual gifts. He thanks God for the blessings. He doesn't actually say anything positive about the church itself. And as a parent, you may have encountered this kind of situation when you walk into one of your kids' rooms and it's a complete tip. And you want to be encouraging, don't you? That's what the manuals say. You should say positive things. And you don't know where to begin because the room is such a mess. And you look up and you say, "My, you've kept the ceiling tidy this week." Whatever it is, you're looking hard for things that you can say that will be positive. And Paul wants to remind these people, this is a ceiling kept tidy sort of a statement that he's making. He's saying, whatever the situation you're in, God is able to bring you through it. It's not just that God has confirmed once by founding you as a church, by calling you out, by calling you away from whatever it was that you were involved in. God is also going to make you firm. God is faithful. Some of us might have given up on that church. We might have said, look, the best thing to do is to go back and found another church in some other, starting in some other part of the city. But that's not what Paul does. Paul says, God has confirmed his word to you. He is going to make it work for you. God is faithful. And wherever you are in your life, I'd just like you to take that away from this week, if you like. Don't forget about everything else that's happened, and the worship and the songs and everything else. But if you're looking for something to sort of chew over, it might be worth thinking about the fact that God is faithful. And you might think, you know, my Christian life, I'm getting to the end of my life at the moment, and I've never really been able to make it work. It's the same old, same old. I've never really been able to enjoy it. And the word for this week is God is faithful. God is able to do in your life what he set out to do. He had plans when he confirmed his word in the first place. Maybe you're a young person and it's just not working, and life just gets scarier and scarier. And each time you think you've solved something or gotten over a hurdle, you just discover that there's a whole lot more to come, and it's just a whole lot more work than it was. Isn't there the story about the little girl that goes to school and she comes back from her first day at school and her mum says, "How did it go?" And she said, "Not very well, I've got to go back tomorrow." And of course, for most of us, we just think, you know, as soon as we've gotten over the first bit of sort of trial or whatever, we think it's going to be easy, and it isn't. Well, the word again is God is faithful. God had promises in mind when he called you. He's confirmed the word that God has brought to your mind, has brought to your heart, the changes that have taken place in your life, and he will make you firm. God is faithful. And so as he introduces himself in this letter, what he really wants to remind people about is that it's not about them, it's about God. It's not about the mess that they may have made. It's not about the fact that their church, like our church, has really great things happening and some very sad things happening at the same time. It's not the problem for God, because God is faithful. So, how has God been faithful in confirming his word to you? So often if you read the Psalms, particularly the ones where the psalmist is in a really difficult position, one of the things that the psalmist does is sort of grabs himself by the scruff of the neck and reminds himself of all of the things that God has done in the past. God's goodness over decades sometimes in the past. How has God been faithful in confirming his word to you? And that's something to take away and to think about over the coming week. What will God say to us through this letter? We might think, what have we got in common with a church that didn't speak our language, didn't share any of our culture, where everybody who was part of that church died nearly 2,000 years ago? What have we got in common with that church? What's God going to say to us through the letter? If you want to find out, you might try reading some of it over the coming week. In fact, I think if you're doing the Bible readings, I don't know whether that was a cunning plan, whether that was all brought together deliberately or whether it's accidental, but if you're reading the Bible reading plan for the New Testament for this church at the moment, you're in 1 Corinthians right now. Is that right?
Yeah,
towards the end of it. Okay, so you've got to go back and do a little bit of reading on your own. And then finally, what is our role in what God is doing around the world? What role might we play? And perhaps there's been a special poignancy to that question that I hadn't expected us to have as a result of the stories that we've heard this morning from other people who have gotten up and shared. Because I think that one of God's purposes is that God's people in one part of the world should be a blessing to other parts of the world too. I don't know where it's going to go. I think I know where next week's going to go, but after that, we'll find out. Thanks very much indeed. All the best, Gillian.
Thank you, Terry.